Today is Monday, August 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the death toll from a deadly earthquake in Indonesia climbs to nearly 100.
98 fatalities confirmed so far, and over 200 seriously injured. That number is expected to rise.
Plus, U.S. sanctions on Iran are set to go into effect just after midnight on Tuesday. What effect will they have on the Iranian economy? And what is face blindness? We'll take a look into this brain disorder that was first described 150 years ago. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. On Sunday, a powerful 6.9 earthquake rocked Indonesia's Lombok Island. The quake was felt on the neighboring Gili Islands, as well as Bali, Sumbawa, and parts of East Java, even triggering a brief tsunami warning. Authorities say nearly 100 people have died and more than 200 have been seriously injured. Monday, Indonesian President Joko Widodo called for immediate action.
Mitigation of this quake should be done as fast as possible, be it evacuation of the dead or the injured. They should be treated as properly as possible, as well as logistics and other things.
Reporter Jack Hewson is in Jakarta, and he joins me by phone. Jack, can you quickly give us an idea of what's taking place on Lombok?
Well, authorities are trying to organize themselves to deal with the numbers of casualties and various injured, which have been brought about by the earthquake. 98 fatalities confirmed so far, and over 200 seriously injured. That number is expected to rise. Thousands of buildings have been reported as damaged, with significant numbers of those having collapsed. And as rescuers continue to look through the ruins of those buildings, more bodies are likely to be discovered over the remainder of today and the rest of the week. Images are emerging of field hospitals being set up to deal with the injured. The physical hospitals that have been built with bricks and mortar, they're already full, reportedly. So they're having to improvise with tents and setting up in hospital car parks and random other places. Currently, more than 200 are counted as severely injured. There have been calls for local blood donations made by the Indonesian Red Cross. Local news has also reported that an Indonesian Navy hospital ship has been dispatched to the island to help with the casualties. So at the moment, authorities are trying to deal with significant numbers of injured, significant numbers of fatalities, and also with a large number of tourists who are trying to get off of the island, which have been traumatized by this earthquake.
The president has called for quick evacuations. What kind of operations are undertaken to get those who are seriously injured to better facilities? As you mentioned, the hospitals are cramped there, and there's makeshift tents, but as well as the tourists.
Well, for the tourists, the Navy has actually laid on boats to try and take them off of the Gili Islands, which are three contiguous islands that sit off of the northwest of Lombok, which are very popular with foreign tourists. There were quite chaotic scenes which were posted on social media of thousands of people on a beach trying to get onto this Navy ship this morning. As far as I'm aware, people have now been taken off of the Gili Islands. However, there's extremely long queues at Lombok International Airport, where there are cracks in the wall and the glass from the shake over the last few days. The government reportedly put on more flights to help people get off the island, but there are still delays at the airport, as far as I'm aware. For the rest of the island, people can either try to leave by boat or move to higher ground if they're concerned about tremors. But for now, I think most people will be trying to leave by air. And if they can land their planes, the faster people will be getting out there.
You mentioned that some of the brick-and-mortar buildings had collapsed as a result of the quake. What about utilities, power, water, sewage?
There have been various power outages over the course of the last 24 hours. I'm not too sure what areas have had power restored to them, but this is a battle that authorities have been fighting over the last day. Obviously, it's likely that things will come back online. The infrastructure is relatively poor in Lombok. The quality of architecture, the quality of building is not high. So it may take some time to restore power to everybody that needs it.
Jack Hewson is a reporter based out of Jakarta, Indonesia. He joins us by phone. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Last week, 17 people were killed when a 6.4 magnitude earthquake hit Lombok. Like Bali, Lombok is known for its pristine beaches and mountains. Indonesia is prone to earthquakes due to its location on the Pacific Ring of Fire, an arc of volcanoes and fault lines in the Pacific Ocean Basin. In December 2004, a magnitude 9.1 earthquake off of Sumatra Island triggered a tsunami that killed 230,000 people in a dozen countries. Among other top stories, U.S. President Donald Trump on Sunday defended the 2016 meeting his oldest son, Donald Trump Jr., held with a Kremlin-linked lawyer to get information on his opponent, Democrat Hillary Clinton, saying it was totally legal and done all the time in politics. Venezuelan authorities have arrested six people they call terrorists and hired killers in what President Nicolas Maduro says was an assassination attempt against him. Zimbabwe's main opposition party says it will make a statement Tuesday about its plans to challenge the country's election results in the courts, though it alleges the judicial system is biased against it. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is at voanews.com and on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Fast radio bursts, or FRBs, are brilliant, powerful, but quick pulses of electromagnetic energy at radio wavelengths. In a posting to the Astronomer's Telegram website, scientists working with the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, or CHIME, a radio telescope in British Columbia, Canada, say they spotted an FRB with a frequency as low as 580 megahertz on July 25th. They say this is the first detection of a fast radio burst at radio frequencies below 700 megahertz. In a recent tweet, astrophysicist Dr. Emily Petrov says that most of the FRBs detected so far have been found at frequencies between 1,000 to 1,500 megahertz. The CHIME team says that since spotting the July 25th FRB, they also detected but not verified others at even lower frequencies. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. Renewed U.S. sanctions on Iran are set to go into effect just after midnight Tuesday, targeting Iran's purchases of dollars, its trade in gold and other precious metals, and industrial-related software. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the United States intends to fully enforce the sanctions to push back on Iran's malign activity. The U.S. withdrew from the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement in May, setting the stage for so-called snapback sanctions. A second set will take effect in November. Meanwhile, Iran has eased foreign exchange rules in a bid to revive its currency. The rial has fallen sharply in recent weeks, losing half of its value since April. Ian Lustig is a University of Pennsylvania political science professor. He told VOA's Victor Beatty that sanctions will have a deleterious effect on the Iranian economy.
It will prevent the country from achieving some of the goals that it has had, like lowering employment, lowering inflation, increasing investment in certain areas. So it will definitely prevent the regime from accomplishing many of its goals. It will not cause serious shortages of items or goods or material that are required for the country to operate. But the real question in the long run about how much economic damage they'll do has to do with how tough the United States will be with its European allies. The sanctions that we are reimposing forbid a variety of economic and financial transactions by anyone in dollars with Iran, which puts European countries and companies and banks in difficult choice situations. Do they want to defy the United States and operate illegally with respect to the United States, thereby possibly endangering their assets? Or do they want to honor what the EU is saying, which is to continue to support the nuclear agreement? But in any event, the economic consequences will not be enough to shake the regime. And if you listen to Secretary of State Pompeo, he's not claiming that that's what's going to happen, though it seems clear that the United States really is after regime change in Iran. He says the sanctions will make it so difficult in Iran to meet its economic objectives that they'll have to reduce support for what he calls their export of terrorism, their activities mainly, I guess, in Syria, but also in Yemen.
The drop in the currency, the rial, and soaring inflation have sparked sporadic protests against profiteering and corruption, many protesters chanting anti-government slogans. Is this also a way to foment unrest at home?
Well, it's a way to try to, but let's take a look at this drop in the price of the value of the rial. The reason that happened is that back in April, the government said, okay, since they're going to reimpose the sanctions, we're going to control transactions in dollars. Everybody, there's going to be a fixed exchange rate of 42,000 rials to the dollar. When that was imposed, people start to not believe in the rial anymore. So what happened more recently is the government said, okay, forget about that. We are going to let the rial float on the market, even with the U.S. sanctions, and we believe it'll be better. And in fact, the value of the rial has come up somewhat. The real question is political. These sanctions will hurt the middle class in Iran most, and that's the group that is the backbone of the reformist movement, presumably the people we would like to take control. So they will be scrambling around trying to keep their heads above water and won't have much time for political activity. Meanwhile, the Revolutionary Guard and the radicals, who have always said that the nuclear agreement was a mistake, that the United States is only out for regime change, that Iran needs nuclear weapons sooner rather than later in order to prevent an American attack on Iran, these are the groups that will likely, at least in the short run, gain politically.
Ian Lustig said, with U.S. sanctions enforcement, a wedge has developed between the U.S. and its European allies, who wish to keep the Iran nuclear deal alive. He said this gives Russia and China an opportunity for even closer ties with Tehran. The European Union said it would trigger an EU law that shields European companies from U.S. sanctions. EU Commission spokesperson described what the protective measures, or the so-called blocking statute, would do when they go into effect.
Will allow EU operators to recover damages arising from U.S. extraterritorial sanctions from the persons causing them and nullifies the effect in the EU of any foreign court rulings based on them. It also forbids EU persons from complying with those sanctions.
The statute is the most powerful tool at the European Union's immediate disposal. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb recently spoke exclusively with Chief of Naval Operations Admiral John Richardson. They discussed a wide array of topics. Carla started her conversation with Admiral Richardson by asking him about the reactivation of the U.S. Navy Second Fleet and the importance of the North Atlantic.
I'll just put it in the context of this. We just did another trip recently where we visited a lot of our Northern European allies and partners. Started in Norway, went to Denmark, to the United Kingdom, and then to Iceland. And there were two themes that emerged from those visits that every one of those nations really touched on. One was they were also very interested in what we intended to do with this second fleet, right? What is this going to do? What does it mean? And the other thing was that they were very mindful of the resurgent Russian threat, not only in the Baltic, not only in the eastern Mediterranean, but also, you know, out into the North Atlantic. And particularly their undersea threat, I would say, is on many people's minds.
What kind of threat are we talking about?
I would say operating in at a tempo that we haven't seen since the end of the Cold War, right? And it doesn't go up to the Cold War levels where they had, you know, a lot bigger navy, but the tempo has definitely picked up and we're seeing sort of unprecedented levels of activity over the last 25 years.
Okay, what about the Chinese? Are they a threat in the Northern Atlantic or is it really just a Russian threat?
You know, the Chinese are definitely present in that theater, you know, particularly since we're talking about the Second Fleet in the maritime domain. And so we've seen Chinese naval expeditionary task forces move around the North Atlantic into the Atlantic, the Mediterranean. They do, you know, make visits there. And so this is a new dynamic. You know, I mean, even 5 years ago, we wouldn't have seen anything like this. So as this theater gets more complicated, more complex, more active, we're going to need some kind of a command structure that can respond to that. And so what we've got is the Second Fleet was stood up exactly to address that challenge.
It feels from the outside that China in the South China Sea is incrementally inching forward, trying to change the rules. What is the U.S. response to that? How does the U.S. counter that?
Well, I think our response would be consistency. And so we have, for 70 years now, been consistently present in the South China Sea at about the same force levels, right? I mean, nothing has elevated too much or decreased too much. We've been pretty steady, consistent. During that time, we have consistently advocated for the set of behaviors in accordance with rules and norms that has really, over those seven decades, fueled the emergence of the Asian economies. I mean, it really has been remarkable. And so that is our plan going forward.
That was VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb speaking with the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral John Richardson. This is International Edition.
Border Crossings knows you want the hottest music, and we're here to give it to you.
Give me something nice and shiny.
Join host Larry London at 1500 Universal every weekday in August for your chance to win a copy of the new Now That's What I Call Music, Volume 67 CD.
Music to my ears.
Featuring the biggest hits from Maroon 5.
Girls like you run around with guys like me till sundown. When I come through, I need a girl like you.
Selena Gomez.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'd go back to you.
Post Malone, Cardi B, and more. This is your all-access pass to the biggest songs of the summer.
Hey, 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 special delivery.
Don't miss out on your chance to snag a free copy of Now 67, with different ways to win every weekday in August.
I'm the girl who's going to win the special prize at the end.
Well, you do seem confident, and confidence is key.
Only on Border Crossings.
From the Voice of America, this is International Edition. While many people complain of struggling to put a name to a face, a rare disorder causes some people to not recognize faces at all. Prosopagnosia, also called face blindness, is a brain disorder in which people cannot recognize faces, sometimes even those of their family. Sadie Witowski has more.
If you met Dasha Reed on the street, you would probably not guess she suffered brain damage as a child. But you might notice something odd if upon second meeting, she did not recognize you.
Face processing is especially dependent on the right temporal lobe, and so it's on the side here.
Although she has generally recovered, Reed now suffers from prosopagnosia, or face blindness. With support from the National Science Foundation, psychologist Brad Duchesne and his collaborators at Dartmouth College are studying how people recognize and process faces.
My main interest is trying to understand the organization of the normal brain. And we use these brains that have suffered brain damage to try to make inferences about the way the normal brain operates.
Although acquired prosopagnosia was first formally described 150 years ago, it is rare and not well understood. Duchesne has gathered 20 participants with the disorder to create a database with results from a battery of tests.
You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Like the famous FACES task.
I don't know. John Travolta.
Yeah, baby.
The chin. You can't deny the chin.
They also test other aspects of perception and memory for objects.
And so imagine that we find somebody who suffered brain damage and they can't recognize faces any longer, but they can still recognize cars in a parking lot and they can recognize scenes and things like that. What that suggests is that faces are processed by different mechanisms in the brain.
Researchers look at the brain structure using MRI and test brain activity using functional MRI, while patients look at faces or scenes.
They are missing certain parts of the brain, or they have damaged certain parts of the brain, and we see that in MRI scans. And so if the part's not there, it can't act on anything. So we can make inferences on what that part does.
We hope that by really developing an understanding of face processing itself, that'll provide us with sort of a model for understanding the way other parts of the brain work.
Duchesne says his basic research on face blindness will not directly lead to any treatments, but Reed still wants to participate. With her help, researchers can better understand how we recognize the world and people around us. Sadie Witkowski, VOA News, Washington.
The actress who played the house mother in the American television sitcom The Facts of Life has died. AP Entertainment editor Oscar Wells Gabriel reports on the life and career of Charlotte Ray.
You take the good, you take the bad.
The role that for many would define Charlotte Rae's career began not on The Facts of Life, but on Different Strokes. It was there that she first portrayed Edna Garrett before NBC spun off Facts of Life the following season. In this 2016 interview, Rae said that she and the cast of the show remained in touch over the years.
I'm still close to the girls. They're beautiful. They're beautiful. Now it's woman to woman, not woman to children.
Charlotte Rae died yesterday. Her publicist says she was diagnosed last year with bone cancer, this after beating pancreatic cancer. Charlotte Rae was 92. Two of her young charges on The Facts of Life were on social media to talk about their colleague and friend. Mindy Cohn, who played Natalie, says Rae was a champion, a teacher, and an example of the tenacity and perseverance that's needed to live life in the creative arts. Kim Fields, who was 2D on the show, said that she had no words at the time, only love, tears, and smiles. And Tony Award-winning actress Audra McDonald tweets that Rae was sweet, funny, wise, lovely, and brilliant, and will be missed. I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
Boy, I do remember watching The Facts of Life and Different Strokes when I was growing up. Before I go, on this day in 1945, the U.S. B-29 Superfortress, the Enola Gay, dropped an atomic bomb, codenamed Little Boy, on Hiroshima, Japan, resulting in an estimated 140,000 deaths. Now, if you're in Washington, you can see this aircraft at the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum, Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center, located near Dulles International Airport. And in 1926, Gertrude Erdell became the first woman to swim across the English Channel, arriving in Kingstown, England, from France in just over 14 hours. Well, that's going to do it for me today on International Edition. I'd like to thank you so much for joining us. To keep up with the latest pictures, video stories, and more, be sure to follow The Voice of America on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A huge thanks to Patrice Martin for directing today's program and to John Dryden for engineering the broadcast. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a magnificent Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Many believers of different faiths have suffered grievously at the hands of ISIS, including Muslims, Christians, Druze, and others, said Vice President Mike Pence at the Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom. But perhaps no faith community has been so systematically and cruelly targeted by ISIS as the Yazidis. 4 years ago, ISIS entered the Sinjar region of Iraq, killing or kidnapping many Yazidi men, women, and children. Nadia Murad, who spoke at the ministerial, said that in her village, ISIS slaughtered more than 600 Yazidi men and boys, including six of Nadia's brothers and stepbrothers. Then they kidnapped Nadia and all the young women and subjugated them to the most degrading form of human slavery. She was only able to escape because her captor left a door unlocked, and the neighboring family hid her until she could be smuggled to safety. Many Yazidi girls weren't so lucky. Thousands remain missing to this day or remain in ISIS captivity. The suffering of the Yazidi people has sickened the American people and mobilized the United States to action. Ensuring that ISIS is defeated remains an urgent priority for the Trump administration, and the U.S.-led global coalition to defeat ISIS will not stop until this enemy has been eliminated. Thanks to these efforts, ISIS so-called caliphates in Iraq and Syria have collapsed, and we will not rest or relent until ISIS is driven from the face of the earth, declared Vice President Pence. Retaking territory is only half the battle. That's why the United States has already devoted more than $110 million to support persecuted religious communities across the Middle East. Vice President Pence announced that the United States will establish the Genocide Recovery and Persecution Response Program. Under this new program, the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development will closely partner with local faith and community leaders to deliver aid to persecuted communities, beginning in Iraq. The United States is also launching a new International Religious Freedom Fund that will leverage our resources, together with funds from other nations, to support those who fight for religious freedom and suffer from religious persecution. Together, said Vice President Pence, we will champion the cause of liberty as never before, and I believe that our combined leadership will make a difference for freedom of faith for generations to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.